This is a Supreme Court-sanctioned murder of what little actual democracy is left in this democracy.
Corporations do not think. They do not breathe. They do not have a conscience.
Undo the disastrous, disastrous impact to our democracy that Citizens United has done.
I think of sort of the movement and struggle to win rights for corporations as sort of one of the least well-known yet most successful civil rights movements in American history.
Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission was a landmark 2010 Supreme Court case concerning regulation of money spent on communications by corporations. Because of First Amendment protections on free speech, the court ruled that the government couldn't restrict corporations from spending money on political ads right before an election.
Last week, the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections.
But a new book called We the Corporations by UCLA law professor Adam Winkler debunks some common wisdom about the Citizens United decision, and it even complicates the narrative about the founding of America.
What was the impetus for writing this book?
Well, in recent years, the Supreme Court has held that corporations have free speech rights in Citizens United, saying they have the same right as individuals to spend money to influence elections, and religious liberty rights. The Supreme Court in the Hobby Lobby saying that the national chain of craft stores was entitled to an exemption from an Obamacare rule that required large employers to cover birth control. And these cases raised an interesting question, which is how did corporations come to have our most fundamental rights, like free speech and religious freedom? And so I wanted to look into that history, and what I found was really remarkable, that corporations have been fighting for equal rights for over 200 years. And while unlike, say, women and racial minorities who fought for their rights by protesting in the streets and marching and parading with signs and making public advocacy for their rights, corporations don't engage in that kind of mass mobilization, but they have fought in the Supreme Court to win landmark rulings by the justices extending the most fundamental rights in the Constitution to them. And today, they have nearly all the same rights as you and me.
Yeah, it kind of happened on the down low. It sort of happened in courtrooms across hundreds of years until we got till today.
I think of sort of the movement and struggle to win rights for corporations as sort of one of the least well-known yet most successful civil rights movements in American history.
A corporation is not a person.
We now see effectively a corporate takeover of our democracy.
It is government of the people, by the corporations, for the corporations.
Everyone says Citizens United was based on this idea of corporate personhood. And one thing I knew just from reading and teaching Citizens United is that that idea actually never comes out in the opinion. The Supreme Court opinion never says corporate personhood, doesn't rely on that idea. Instead, the court says that corporations are associations of people, and that a business corporation like Exxon is essentially like the NAACP, a voluntary membership organization that people support and endorse for their politics and for their larger vision, rather than just to make money. And that's a controversial way of thinking about the corporation, but it's actually one that runs throughout the Supreme Court history. Occasionally, the Supreme Court has said that corporations are people, but much more common is the Supreme Court has said corporations have rights because the people within them, who associate together, they are people and they have rights.
Yeah, it's a listener's rights theory. Can you just like explain that for anybody who's like me, it is not a person with a law degree.
Well, the story of the listener's rights theory of the First Amendment is one that also shows how Ralph Nader was a really important influence that gave us Citizens United. So back in the 1970s...
Ralph Nader.
The consumer rights advocate. In the 1970s, Ralph Nader's organization, Public Citizen, their litigation arm, brought a landmark case to the Supreme Court challenging restrictions on pharmacists' advertising of drug prices. And Nader was interested in not helping pharmacists, but in helping consumers comparison shop on these prices. And these laws prevented the consumers from getting that information. And he takes the case to the Supreme Court, and he argues that the First Amendment protects those rights of consumers to get accurate information, and that this law is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court court agrees with him and adopts this listener's theory of the First Amendment, that same theory would then be used in cases like Citizens United and an important case that I talk about in my book that often goes overlooked, a case in the 1970s called the Bellotti case, where the Supreme Court, even years before Citizens United, said that corporations had political speech rights. And what the court said in these cases is not that corporations are people that have political speech rights, but that, if anything, that corporations' speech is protected because the listeners of corporate speech will want to hear it and value that speech. And their rights mean that corporations can't be prevented from speaking.
What do you think Ralph Nader is going to say when he thumbs through your book and he sees, oh, Ralph Nader's Public Citizen led to Citizens United?
Well, it is true that Public Citizen in years since has come to argue that the whole line of Supreme Court cases that come out of the Virginia Pharmacy case, the Ralph Nader case in the 1970s, should be overturned. Because today, the First Amendment is used largely by corporations and trade associations that represent businesses to fight against regulation. And in fact, a recent empirical study found that 50% of current First Amendment cases that are brought today are brought by corporations and businesses and trade associations.
But it's not as if corporations somehow decided to take over America one day. Winkler says corporations have been around ever since the first Europeans set foot on American soil in the 1600s.
The pilgrims sailed the sea to find a place to call their own. In their ship Mayflower, they hope to find a better home.
One of the fascinating things I found when writing We the Corporations was sort of the early history of America, is tied to this image of the pilgrims, right, who are sort of the perfect example of what the American identity would come to be. They were escaping tyranny. They were exercising their fundamental rights of freedom of religion. They were self-governing and, you know, hardy people who were out there in the wilderness. But 13 years before the pilgrims came in Plymouth, the first permanent English colony was established down in Jamestown. And it was established as a business corporation. It was set up by the Virginia Company of London, one of England's first stock corporations, and it was a money-making enterprise, and the people who were sent were not dissenters or outcasts or people fighting against the king. They were basically employees and investors of the Virginia Company of London, and they were here to try to turn a profit. And as I tell in the book, that in some ways that one of the founding people behind the United States, behind the American experience, was the Virginia Company of London, a very important corporation that introduced representative democracy to America. And not because of some impulse to have progressive reforms, but rather as a way of enticing people to come to the New World by giving them a measure of autonomy. Again, because it was a struggling business corporation that was trying to turn a profit.
Winkler says even important American documents like the Bill of Rights and the Constitution were influenced by the structure of a corporation.
The colonies were originally set up as corporations, and they were governed by colonial corporate charters, charters given to the corporations and the organizers by the government. And the charters would lay out very clearly what the office holders were in the corporation, what the rights were of the stockholders, how often they had to have meetings, and these various things that morphed into basically charters of government.
I wonder why the corporate story sort of didn't find its way into the zeitgeist. Like, how did we miss this?
Well, I think part of the story is that we look back at our history and see what we want to see in us today. And I think when we look back at that founding era, we think of ourselves more in the framework of the pilgrims. They sort of represent the America that we want to become. But the story of America is, of course, always more nuanced and more complicated.
A good example of that nuance was the first corporate rights Supreme Court case in 1809, where we began to see how corporations would use the First Amendment to say that they, too, had a right to be heard in the American legal system.
And it was called Bank of the United States versus DeVoe. It's one of the neglected, overlooked landmarks of American constitutional law, in my opinion. And that case involved the Bank of the United States, which at the time was one of the most powerful corporations in the New World, with branches all the way from Boston to New Orleans, at a time when most businesses were very local. And the Bank of the United States is famous for giving rise to a split among the founders, with Jefferson and Hamilton fighting each other and giving...
The guy from the musical, right?
Right, yeah, exactly. Giving rise to the two competing parties. But not only did it give us rise to the two competing parties and a good rap battle in Hamilton the musical, but also gave rise to this first Supreme Court case. The bank, when Jeffersonians imposed a tax on the bank went to federal court and said, we have a constitutional right under Article 3 of the Constitution to sue Georgia, who imposed this tax on us, in federal court. The problem was is that provision of the Constitution only guarantees the right to sue in federal court to citizens, and yet a corporation was claiming that right too. And although, of course, corporations are not citizens, and the framers didn't write that provision thinking about corporations, the Supreme Court, in an opinion by legendary Chief Justice John Marshall, held that corporations indeed were protected by that provision and did have the right to sue in federal court under this provision for citizens. It's worth noting that a half century later, in the Dred Scott case, the Supreme Court would say that African Americans could not be citizens under that exact same provision of the Constitution.
Dred Scott v. Sanford was a landmark decision from 1857 saying slaves were not citizens of the United States and therefore could not sue in federal court. The decision was later overturned in 1868 by the 14th Amendment.
The 14th Amendment was adopted after the Civil War to protect the rights of the newly freed slaves, guaranteeing them equal protection of the laws. And although the Supreme Court in years to come would refused to recognize that African Americans have significant rights under the 14th Amendment in cases like Plessy against Ferguson, upholding Jim Crow laws, the Supreme Court really didn't read the 14th Amendment vibrantly to protect African Americans until Brown versus Board of Education in the 1950s. So many, many years, almost a century after it was adopted. But in that time, corporations actually took advantage of that and won rights under the 14th Amendment. The Southern Pacific Railroad launched a remarkable series of cases in the 1880s. What the lawyers called test cases, designed specifically to give corporations 14th Amendment rights. And it was a crazy series of cases. Two of them made it to the Supreme Court. In the first, the Southern Pacific Railroad's lawyer, who's an illustrious man who was once nominated and confirmed to the Supreme Court himself, a guy named Roscoe Conkling, he lied to the Supreme Court claiming that the framers of the 14th Amendment intended to protect business corporations. And he testified from his own experience he had been one of the framers of the 14th Amendment. But it turns out that historians now know that he did not tell the truth to the Supreme Court. When Conkling argued his case before the Supreme Court in 1882, he was the last surviving member of the drafting committee of the 14th Amendment. So there was no one there to refute his story.
You talk about like so many test cases brought by corporations. Why are they so good at it? And why maybe persons, real persons, human beings, if you will, or not?
Well, it turns out that the court system is a perfect playing field for business corporations. Business corporations have been able to have the resources to hire the most expensive lawyers that money can buy in the country. You know, think about civil rights movements and the women's rights movement, traditionally underfunded, has struggled to have enough resources to bring cases.
By expensive, you mean really good lawyers, people that cost a lot of money and
right.
get results.
Right. I mean, the reason why those lawyers are the most expensive lawyers in the country is because they're often the best lawyers in the country. They're often great lawyers that don't charge as much money. And if we think about the great lawyers of the civil rights movement, like Thurgood Marshall, was never paid much money, but was a great, great lawyer. Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the women's rights movement. But there have also been great lawyers on behalf of business corporations, all the way back to Daniel Webster, who was one of the greatest Supreme Court advocates ever, argued more than 220 cases in the Supreme Court in the early 1800s, many of them on behalf of business corporations and seeking constitutional protections for business clients. And so corporations have always been able to, one, hire the best lawyers that money can buy, two, always had the appetite for risk, willingness to pursue potentially losing lawsuits. Because, you know, if you can defeat a regulation that really prevents you from making millions and millions of dollars, the fact that you might spend a little bit of money challenging that law in court, it's just the cost of doing business. And so, and today, for instance, there is an elite Supreme Court bar in Washington that studies show is much more effective at getting their cases heard by the Supreme Court, and that those lawyers today represent primarily business corporations.
One of the most interesting parts of your book is this sort of liberal fight for corporations and the First Amendment. It's sort of stories that we don't really think about when we think about Citizens United, but a lot of them come from newspapers. Newspapers suing for their free speech rights. Newspapers are corporations, New York Times, Washington Post, if you will. Tell us that story. I mean, I think people forget that the place where we get the news also makes money.
That's right. And we, the corporations, it's not very reductionist. When you look back at this history, you find that actually liberals are often arguing for the rights of corporations, and that I find actually surprising limits on the rights of corporation were imposed by the Supreme Court in the notorious Lochner era, a period in the court's history where it was very business friendly, but yet nonetheless imposed limits on the rights of corporations. The story you ask about is really the story about the newspaper corporations who in the 1930s took on Huey Long, Louisiana's iron-fisted demagogue, who was the governor and the senator. And Long won the governorship of Louisiana on the eve of the Great Depression, promising to make Louisiana great again. And
he's sort of a Donald Trump figure.
He was Trump before Trump. I mean, he really was. He was a populist who was great at using the media and a showman.
Hated fake news.
Yeah, no. And in fact, when the major newspapers in Louisiana came out against Huey Long's populism and his program, he accused them of publishing fake news, and his allies imposed a tax on newspaper corporations on their advertising. And those newspapers challenged that tax in court and won a landmark ruling, one of the very first Supreme Court rulings striking down a law for violating the freedom of the press. And the court said that issued a broad opinion that's still cited to this day for press freedoms. And the court said that corporations have that right, too, that in a modern democracy, newspapers check government, encourage democratic deliberation, and they're published by corporations. That's an important precedent from the 1930s that ends up being cited by the Supreme Court all the way, including in Citizens United, as establishing that corporations do have free speech rights, even when they impact politics.
This is a devastating security breach that was leaked out of the Pentagon.
The most highly classified documents of the war.
The Times has 7,000 pages detailing how the White House has been lying about the Vietnam War for 30 years.
The Post, this celebrated movie of the past year that has liberals cheering about the Washington Post standing up for its First Amendment rights, well, we should remember that's a for-profit business corporation standing up for its First Amendment rights, the right to engage in political speech. So it does show that the story behind Citizens United is a complicated one, and it's not just a matter of sort of conservative free market principles applied to campaign finance law, as many people suggest, but actually it's a deeply rooted issue that corporations have had already long before Citizens United established a toehold in American political speech by using the Constitution to expand their rights.
Not many people think about the NAACP being a corporation. People think of it as an association of people, but it definitely had to fight for its free speech rights. You talk about it a little bit in the book. Can you talk about that here?
Yeah, well, so for a long time, the Supreme Court said that business corporations and corporations generally did not have a freedom of association. And what happened in the 1950s is that after Brown versus Board of Education, there were southern states that tried to put the NAACP out of business, stop them from filing lawsuits in their states. And I tell the story about Alabama's effort to shut down the NAACP. Now, of course, the NAACP was not a business, but it turns out it was a corporation, and it's formed and organized as a corporation under New York law, a nonprofit corporation, but takes the corporate form nonetheless. And Alabama tried to use the fact that it was a corporation to put it out of business, to say that we have power to fight against this corporation, impose special rules on this corporation, and the corporation has no freedom of association to hide its membership from us, for instance. The Supreme Court delivers an important victory for the NAACP, saying that the NAACP does, even though it's a corporation, it does have certain fundamental rights of association. That case would then be cited years later in cases brought by business corporations. And indeed, in Citizens United, the Supreme Court kind of envisions business corporations to be like the NAACP, kind of voluntary membership associations that have the same kind of reason for people coming together and joining up.
What's been your reaction to people, politicians that say they want to overturn Citizens United. They are, you know, raising money, creating a lot of attention with this sort of thing. What's been your reaction as a law professor?
Well, there has been this vibrant movement to amend the Constitution to overturn Citizens United. And I think about 19 states have endorsed a constitutional amendment that would declare corporations have no rights and are not people under the Constitution. And while I sympathize with the idea that Citizens United maybe has given corporations and private individuals too much leeway to spend as much money as they want to influence elections, I think that the constitutional amendment to deny corporations all rights would be a real mistake and would go way too far. Corporations must have property rights, or the government could come seize their property to build a mall without paying just compensation. That can't be right. And corporations must have some basic constitutional protections. Otherwise, CNN or the New York Times could both be censored by Donald Trump because they're both corporations. They must have some protections against such government abuse. At the same time, I think what's become real controversial is that in recent years, the Supreme Court has ignored a line that the Supreme Court drew 100 years ago. 100 years ago, the Supreme Court said corporations have property rights, but not liberty rights, that they weren't entitled to the rights of personal conscience or political freedom that ordinary people have, but they were entitled to property protections. It established a principle that the Supreme Court today seems to have forgotten, and I think much of the controversy comes from extending these fundamental liberty rights to corporations.
Is the answer to Citizens United more speech, or is that just quixotic?
Well, I think one of the difficulties is in, under Citizens United, if corporations have the right to spend as much money as they want to influence elections, because of the unique ability of corporations to amass capital, it really does give corporations extensively more rights than individuals, because it'd be hard for very many individuals to match the financing that, say, one company, Apple, could put together if it wanted to influence elections. But we've seen, at least so far, that corporations, especially the biggest brand name corporations, have often stayed at the sidelines since Citizens United, uncertain about whether this kind of spending is a good idea for politics or not. But we're seeing corporations get more and more involved in our political lives. Look, in the wake of the Parkland shooting, we've seen a whole bunch of businesses like Delta and Dick's Sporting Goods and Walmart kind of take on the NRA. So these days we're expecting more of our corporations to engage in political life. So maybe Citizens United is finding more of a home than people realize.
Are they staying on the sidelines because of public shaming, or a public that might be uncomfortable with them being in elections so much?
Well, I think if we look back at history, what we see is that often corporations have seen windows for them to be more active in terms of political spending, but they've been hesitant to take advantage of those windows, often for fear of alienating customers, for fear of alienating workers. But we'll have to see what time will tell. So far, we've seen from Citizens United, it's unleashed more independent spending by individuals than it has by business corporations. We'll have to see how that carries through in the next few cycles.
Well, thank you very much, Adam. We enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
The book is called We the Corporations. For Reason, I'm Paul Dietrich.